terms of re-recording, you know, people picking up, there's still lots of material that hasn't been re-recorded. It was a very, very rich source. That sparked some visits, some exploratory trips into the South, start finding musicians. John Cohen found Roscoe Holcomb very early, and Roscoe was like a key for John in terms of some of the blues musicians. Roscoe picked a lot up from blues musicians, Blind Lemon Jefferson, and well, I've heard a lot of names from him, of blues musicians he listened to. So, and then when once the field trip started, then, wow, there was a lot more there than people thought was there. I think that's mainly it. Touring around was certainly, you know, an impetus too. And it seemed like it was right for the time. In the 50s, people were getting they were crawling up the walls for something. Young people, especially in the universities. It's different now than it was then. They were crawling up the walls looking for something different, to get out of the cage. And many people saw old-time music as a way to do that. So in the 60s, almost to the end of the 60s, the Ramblers did almost all of their appearances at universities, colleges, that kind of that atmosphere.
Jerry?
I think Sparky and Doogie and somebody else, in talking about all the influences on your music, said that there's no pure music anymore. Do you think music, as it came to this country, was pure anything? Don't you think? This is just, maybe it's speeded up lately, but African music had all kinds of influences. French music had all kinds of influences before it got here. It's just a continuation of the process.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, whether you want to admit it or not, war has quite a lot to do with it. When the Crusades went into the Holy Lands and brought the dulcimer back to England, that changed a whole lot of things. Of course, then you got people like John R. who influenced a lot of us when we were growing up listening to him right after Billy Graham went off on Sunday nights, and he'd play all that blues and country and stuff. It's like you get your soul saved, then you get snatched right back to the devil.
I was thinking that it was, you know, Tracy was talking about the importance of records. It was also the record companies and the need to sell records that, for better or worse, defined musical categories, because I had to call it something.
Right.
Just so that people could find it in the store.
Mm-hmm.
And you often have a musician who recorded under several different names doing completely different music,
right.
And you later the collectors found out, well, these are the same two guys.
The Masked Marvel, Charlie Patton. Ooh,
but he sounded the same, no matter what he called it. He sounded like three different guys on one record all the time.
Do you know how Cajun music got to be recorded? Back in the late 20s or middle 20s, somebody invented a little record player called Victrola. And they came down in our part of the country, which was 90% French-speaking people. They had no French record, no Cajun record. So the guy couldn't sell his RCA or Victor record. So he came back and he said, we gotta do something. So they started collecting boys or people from different parts of Acadiana. And with the squeeze box, you know, they started recording. So then they could sell the Victrola, so they could sell the records.
Yeah. Well, the radio stations and the record companies have a lot to do with holding music back, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They want you to record what they know will sell. It would amaze you. The super good blues bands out of Austin, Texas, that they just don't go anywhere. Because they don't fit in a category that the record companies think will sell.
The same thing would have happened in the 20s and 30s too. And you have, like, you take a musician like Reverend Gary Davis, who would only do religious music. He was wonderful, but they didn't think it would sell, so they wouldn't record him. And you have other musicians like Robert Johnson, you only have one type of music recorded of him, and yet there would have been other types of music that he played, but you only have documented one type of thing. And so there were definitely restrictions in what they would record too.
I have no comments.
You want to take it?
That's deeper than I did.
Well,
you want me to take some?
Here comes my theory. You know, no matter what it is, I got a theory. I do know that as people traveled and took the music to various places, like the Kansas City blues style, a lot of people, in terms of where the jobs were, would go to that area, and then all of a sudden they'd take the music, and then it would change because of the influence of the cowboy music and whatnot. And the migratory thing going up to Chicago and taking the music from the South up into Chicago. But in terms of the New Orleans musicians, my God, the Dixieland sound, it just sounds to me as if some of the people stayed home and didn't go anyplace and they got together. Well, let's see what that trumpet sounds like with that banjo. Let's see. Once again, it's musicians getting together and sounding good. In terms of Jimmy Rushing and those classic, as they're called, classic blues singers, they said, well, you know, you sounded good singing by yourself with a guitar. Let's see what it sounds like with a band behind it. I've been fortunate to meet some of these real fine jazz musicians like Eddie Cleanhead Vincent and some people don't know Buddy Anderson, who used to play with Jamie Chan, and he was the man that introduced Charlie Parker to Dizzy Gillespie. In fact, he showed me the corner that it happened in, right outside a rib joint in Kansas City. But it's, like I said, if a musician meets another musician, if I found some opera singer that I liked, I'd probably want to learn the song, although I tend to doubt that would ever happen. But if I did hear some opera music I liked, I would want to learn it, you know, and it's just like if you're a musician, you don't limit yourself. It's once again, it's the people who, yeah, it's the people who give your category that limit you, and I refuse to let people categorize me. I won't let people call me a revivalist. That's one big thing that I have,
care.
Because I say, hey, if it died, then I could revive it, but it never died, so hey, I'll just.
Can I add along? I think also what you had really was the blues developed at a relatively same time the jazz developed. I'm not saying it the same, but I think what you had happen was during the Spanish-American War and then during the First World War, you had instruments become available to blacks. And those were your horns, okay? And a lot of those didn't really find their way into the rural areas, but in the cities they did. And you had a different sophistication. I'm not saying they didn't all together. Are you going to argue with me on that? Okay. We're going to have a fight here. Sure, I've met rural musicians that also played horn section. I'm just saying it seemed to me that it seemed to center in the cities.
Well, unless you think about everything south of there, the Caribbean and South America.
But we're on a jazz. All right, we're going to. Yeah, it seems to me the jazz came out of that coming into the cities and that it developed as a separate tradition.
Yeah.
You know, that they were influenced and that it's an urban thing where those horns are coming in there with the pianos, where you have money to buy a piano, where you have a piano. And where you also, I think, you're just having a little more influence from different areas, whereas you still had the Deep South, which was much more isolated, whereas your towns, you had more people coming in from different areas.
I don't know if any of you have ever heard any of the ragtime that's been played by the bands, like, you know, the very much like the Salvation Army bands with lots of tubas and whatnot, and hear some of that ragtime being played like that, but it really did change the music around, although it was written for piano. But then you get it and play it on the guitar, it's a different sound. You get it and play it with horns, it's a different sound. And I think maybe some of that, of course, you know, even the term jazz is an insult if you know where it originally came from. I have a question I'd like to ask Tracy, and maybe I'm not putting you on the spot, but I'm curious, you know, when you talk about Roscoe Holcomb listening to Blind Lemon Jefferson, where in the dickens did he go to find a Blind Lemon Jefferson, you know, from where he lived? Because, you know, like, records. Let's face it, from records, but who said, oh, I know these black records are sell here in the middle of eastern Kentucky? I mean, you know, you know, I'm real curious about that. You know, Doc Boggs, they're coming out of southwestern Virginia and hearing all, you know, I'm just real curious where they heard that music, you know, and what store they went to. They said, oh, we've got these records that you might want to take it and go home with your dulcimer and play these blues. So, you know, it just, you know, to me, that is just really a strange thing that they did run upon this music, you know, coming, you know, because I know the area that Roscoe came from, and it's just like, I mean, you know, when I drive through that area, I increase the black population by 100%. You know, you know, I'm just real, you know, I don't know if anybody's ever wondered that, but it, you know, I mean, I know, like, that Mother Maybelle traveled with Leslie Riddle, and he taught her how to play that finger-picking style, and then you got Bill Williams, who learned from Blind Blake, and then he taught Merle Travis how to play. Of course, they call it Travis picking, you know, but he, you know, that's really Blind Blake style through Bill Williams that it comes about. But, wow, where did he find those records? You know, that's just amazing.
Well, I really don't know. I know that he did some work in, like, he worked in Cincinnati for a while at Coney Island. That kind of thing. He wasn't home all the time. I remember him talking about being in New Jersey one time working. He did some of that migrant kind of work too. But I think all things are possible.
Been in a while though.
I can imagine that he wouldn't have too much trouble getting a hold of the records.
I haven't found a lot in West Virginia. Records. Speak up a little bit.
This is in my basically Western swing music, being in an area that plays traditionally around beat old time music, it's a very pleasant age. 1922, we got radio. I started listening to Bob, you know, the Bob Wills type people, and then later on in the 30s and stuff, and he picked up his music style on the radio. And it seems like when radio came in, people started getting radio sets, places of most traditional music changed from people who got recorded by Riley.
Grand Ole Opry was the thing that we used to listen to every Saturday night. And when I listened to music, other than Cajun music, was hillbilly music. There was no bluegrass, old-timey, blues. It was non-Cajun, so it was American music.
Don't leave the hayride.
That's right. And also the hayride, you know.
Yeah. Midday merry-go-round.
I beg your pardon?
Did you get the midday merry-go-round down that way?
No, I don't remember it.
Yeah, it came out of Knoxville.
Mm-hmm. As a victim of this need for compartmentalization, right. who's doing it? The promoters? We all agree that there are no pure musicians in the sense, I mean, anybody who's a good musician is listening to everybody and everything. I'll give you a good example. Howard Armstrong, right? Most everybody knows. He plays everything, you know, just he studies the music, he plays every instrument.
Sweetheart of Sigma Chi.
He sings in six different languages, all right? We were just at a festival in Davenport, Iowa, a blues festival. There were people in the group that did not want Howard to be at the festival because they didn't see him as a blues musician. They saw him as a folk musician. Compartments. Okay, this is a blues festival. Much of the blues that you're hearing this week, that you'll hear tomorrow night, is not considered blues. By most promoters in the country, blues promoters, because it's country, it's folk music, that kind of thing.
good
the
music.
The audience appreciated the musician. They didn't care what music he was playing. He did a Hawaiian song. And they didn't care about that. I think most audiences don't care. That festival is making a name for itself now because it is introducing other people, acoustic people, what are considered folk blues, now at a blues festival. They're drawing good crowds now, though they are traditionally not what most people would consider blues today. If you don't play electric, it's not blues. Okay? So who's coming up with these compartments? It's the promoters, the record companies. They're trying to keep pure styles. And yet, musicians aren't going along with this. And neither is the audience. The audience is content to hear different things. You have to sometimes have a certain look to be that musician. Am I wrong?
No, you're not, because a lot of people always complain about my cowboy clothes, and I say, you know, I dress the way I want to dress, you know, unless they're, you know, going to buy my spangled suits or whatever it is they expect me to wear, you know.
I have a very well-known, respected promoter from the West Coast, Blues Festival, tell me, flat, straight to my face, that he hires black musicians. People come to a blues festival. Black musicians, and if you're white and play blues, you better be really well known. In fact, you have to be rock and roll like Jerry Winters. Otherwise, people won't believe that you play the blues.
Show them your curly hair and dark skin and tell them what you're doing.
We're at the mercy of these people that are telling audiences what they want to see.
What they want to hear.
What they want.
Certainly in the late 50s with the rock and roll, where they just, every good black song had to have a cover artist, right? You had to have a white musician put it out, and it was, you know, it was definitely the record companies doing it, you know, to my mind.
Bill, you grew up in Washington, and you didn't grow up hearing all around you the music that you play today, did you? Or
no.
Did
No, I mean,
what was your exposure to that?
To the music I play.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, in the church, when someone talked about the church, my folks are from Birmingham, Alabama, and I think where I fell in love with like the blues sound was listening to my grandmother at the prayer meeting, doing what they call line of hymns. Mm-hmm. I used to walk to her church in outside of Birmingham, a town called Fisville, on Friday evening. And then wait for outside the church until she got finished and then walk her back home. I used to listen to her.
He could hear the music but not the preaching.
But I mean, the thing is, when I was growing up, like I was exposed to all different styles of music and I like all different styles of music. But I chose to play the style of music I play because, you know, it's good music. Like what Art Sparky said, you know, about the interim revivals, I don't think that there's any danger in that style of music dying because it was born, I mean, in you know, this fire of like hard times and adversities, but it was born, was created for the purpose of helping people overcome those hard times. And so it has this power that, you know, will make it survive. And
Dr.
So
Blues.
You listen to it today, and it's still, you know, the same kind of music that I want to hear on Saturday after hard work. Friday night, you know, it's still got that same power to it.
I had a question about that. You know, I've heard it called the age of ambivalence. You know, we see the oil spills on TV, and you know, we still drive our cars, and you know, sort of the complex 1989, and now there's this revival though of the blues, which is, you know, punching through and feeling like a simple, strong message, you know, sort of to simple problems, not simple problems, but, I don't know, hard times problems, and see, you know, why this revival?
12 years of a Republican administration. I'm serious about that.
When you talk about the record industry too, I mean, when you listen to what you can get on the radio now, it's like there's all these folk music that people created out of necessity to just to express themselves, express their feelings, to, like I said, the cure for the hard times they're going through. And then you have all this music that was created purely for money, you know, and it doesn't seem to have roots in a lot of things that are human. You know, I mean, I think that, like, you know, when people talk about similarities and differences, when, you know, one of the bluesiest sounds I ever heard is the Irish penny whistle, you know. There's people basically from all over the world. They laugh, they sound just about the same, and when they cry, they sound just about the same. So these types of music that were created, you know, in communities out of necessity, will touch just about anybody that's human, you know. Doesn't, you know, mm-hmm. But the record industry and the people that make the money are the ones that have to separate and isolate it, you know, pack it.
Well said. I think I would like to expound a theory. And if it's worthless, then run that little machine.
Get it out.
But I feel like we're at a turning point in academic folklore scholarship, because they've made just about all the mistakes they can possibly make to this point. And basically what I feel is, that's exactly what Sparky said very early. He said they're so narrow. And I think what that is not just folklorists. I think the Western mind is that way. The Western mind tries to specialize and tries to get to the bottom of the truth by specializing so narrowly that they're missing 3/4 or 9/10 of what's going on. And there's been, well, for years and years, there have been people who've made forays into the Eastern world, Eastern philosophy, and brought some of it back. You know, Hermann Hesse and people like that. He comes from a country where they would specialize like crazy.
Get in,
he was going for this big picture. And I feel that we're almost at a turning point now where things are going to be looked at more in that way in terms of this music, because we were leading up to it, not talking about it all the time. So that exactly what Dewey said we're the same. The music brings us together, and that fits in with the thought of the universal, the universe, and everybody belonging to the universe, and the universe of souls and everything. And when you think of that philosophy, and then you see what folklorists have done and people categorizing music, you know, they're miles apart, and the solution is going to be some kind of a mixture of those two thoughts, and I think that's coming sometime in the next 10 years. We'll all be on the same stage together.
Aren't we now, though?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point. See, the movement is like bubbling up from, you know, from the grassroots, and it's just gonna, it's like cattle pressing against a fence in a corral. One day they're all gonna break out. And the smart folklorists, you know, at first they're gonna say, well, boy, you know, we're containing the cattle. Then when they burst out like that, they're gonna say, oh, great, free range cattle.
Well, I think we've got a lot to think about with all of this, and I'm sitting here trying to think of how we can do the Augusta program last year without naming any of the classes. So maybe instead of having Blues Week and Cajun Week and Old Time Week, maybe we'll just have one great big five.
Come on down.
Just come down and we'll think of a name for it after you get here. So thank you very much, everybody who contributed so much.